This week's Torah portion, Beha'aloscha, means the word itself, Beha'aloscha, means to lift up, to lift up. It comes from the Hebrew word aliyah, which means to elevate, to lift up. Specifically, in the context of the Parsha, it means to light the menorah, to kindle, to light, to ignite the lamps of the menorah. And even though generally Beha'aloscha means to lift something up, in Hebrew, the word for igniting or lighting something is lihadlik, which, as you are all familiar, this is the blessing that we make before lighting the Shabbat candles. Lihadlik, nershal Shabbat, to light. So why does the Torah not use the word lihadlik if the general understandable way of lighting is lihadlik, to light? Why does the Torah say behalosa, to lift up, which is a poetic way of saying make the fire elevate, yep, lift up, make the fire move? It's a wonderfully poetic way of saying it, but why, in fact, does the Torah use that? And of course, Rashi, the commentator on the Chumash, asks right away that question, and he explains that this lets us know, by the way, by using such an expression, that there are two additional requirements for lighting the menorah. You can't just go light the menorah any which way. Number one, Rashi says, you have to make sure that when you light the menorah, the fire that you're lighting, that you're using, is holding itself to the wick long enough for the flame to really catch on. Sometimes you could be in a hurry and light very quickly, and the flame is sort of sputtering, not really burning well yet. So it's in the language of Rashi, the Gemara, quoting the Gemara Midrash, Achitehe shalhevet ola me'alea. The shalhevet, the flame, has to be able to be really fully ignited and lit in the wick. And the second thing Rashi says is, it also teaches us the word beha'aloscha, to go up, to lift up, to elevate, that when the Kohen would light the menorah, he would not reach up his hand high, because the menorah was 18 tefachim. 18 tefachim is about 5 feet tall, the menorah. So he would not lift up his hand high, lift up his hand to light, but he would stand on a step or two or three, a little stone that was made into one or two steps, and he would stand on those steps and then light the menorah. So the Kohen himself would be lifted up, would be elevating himself, meaning going up on these steps in order to light the menorah. So that's why Rashi, again, the literal, the commentator who himself says about himself that he's teaching us the more literal, the pshat, the more literal meaning of the verse, of the pasuk, of the Torah, Rashi explains to us these two things. Further in the parsha, we read about the Jews complaining about the man. The man was food, as you know, that came down from heaven every single morning, every day. And the Jews had the man for 40 years, the Torah tells us, from 1 month after leaving Egypt until 1 month into coming into Israel. They were able to still eat from the man that was still left over for 40 years. So let's talk a little bit about, and there's other topics, as you may see from the summary in the Aliyah of the Parsha. But let's talk about these two topics, the topic of lighting the menorah and the topic of the man. And in fact, why is the Torah telling us the beha'aloscha, to lift up? The menorah lighting, the menorah, first of all, had to be done with a menorah, the Torah tells us, of 7 branches. The menorah had 7 branches. And the 7 branches, the Torah tells us, were made it from a menorah that was completely one piece of gold. It was solid gold. You were not allowed to take pieces of gold and solder them together to make this candelabra, to make this menorah. You had to have one solid piece of gold and then hammer it out and soften it and heat it and work it and carve it in such a way that eventually the solid chunk, the solid block of gold, became a candelabra. As a matter of fact, the Torah tells us that this was such a difficult feat to accomplish that Hashem himself made the menorah at the end of the day. The craftsmen couldn't figure out how to make the menorah out of one solid chunk of gold. It was very involved. The very description in the Torah of the menorah was that the 7 branches each had decorations, and they had knobs, and they had things that looked like cups and things that looked like flowers decoration in the silver, in the rather in the gold, decorating the stems and the arms of the menorah. So that's another thing to keep in mind. The menorah had to be one solid piece of gold, and it had seven lamps. Question again, why one solid piece of gold, to the point where when the craftsman couldn't do it, Hashem himself, Moshe says, threw the gold in the fire and miraculously came out this menorah. Why one piece of gold and why seven lamps? Why not one lamp? Why not two lamps, five lamps, 10 lamps? Why seven lamps? We know the Hanukkah menorah has eight lamps plus one, nine lamps. And the answer is, going back to our study of Tanya and going back to our study of the Kabbalah, the mystical elements of the Torah, that is that there are seven different attitudes, seven emotional attitudes amongst human beings and amongst the Jewish nation, obviously, also. And those seven attitudes in the language of the Kabbalah are called Chesed, Gvura, Tiferes, Netzach, Hod Yisod, Malchus. There are seven different. We're not going to go into what they are. We've discussed them in our study of Tanya. We will again discuss them on Mondays, God willing. But suffice it to say that there are seven different, all good, all wonderful, but their character traits, their personality. Everybody knows my personality, not the same as your personality. We're best friends, but we don't have the same way of looking at life 100%. I'm a little more impetuous. You're a little bit more cautious. I'm a little more reserved. You're a little bit more emotional. Whatever it is, everybody is different. And in fact, if everybody would be the same, it would be a very boring world. And in fact, if everybody were the same, you wouldn't need all the people. The reason Hashem creates each and every one of us is because every single person not only contributes to the totality of the job, but because the difference between people is what creates harmony. Harmony is when you have different people with different tones in their voices singing together. If everybody has the same exact tone and you have a choir of people singing together with the same exact tone, that's not a choir. Then it sounds like one person is singing. By definition, when people get together and they're a little bit different, but yet they have common purpose, they have common goal, by definition, that's beautiful. That's amazing. You may have seen, of course, the clips of these attempts to bring together hundreds of people singing a song together. I posted on my Facebook page a song of the men's choir in yeshiva singing together, beautiful song. And it's amazing. It really is amazing when you have hundreds of people singing together. This is the story of the Jewish nation. So the story of the Jewish nation is, and this is what the Torah teaches us, that each of us, even though there are seven major differences in personality, but then there are minor differences amongst those seven, because as we know from the time when we count the Sefirah Sa'omer, which we just finished a few weeks ago, each of the seven is further composed of seven, and it's further broken down, and nobody's exactly a certain type of personality. So each and every one of us has some uniqueness to ourselves, and we all are holy. We all are part of this golden menorah. And the golden menorah had to be one piece initially, not soldered together. And the reason it had to be one piece initially is because, as we again studied in Tanya, each of our neshamas, each of our souls, comes from the same pool initially. So the truth is that are we different? No, we're in fact not different. In fact, we are all one. And because our neshama is all connected, we come from the same source, the same pool of energy, in the spiritual realms, in the spiritual worlds, and from that gets ladled out a little bit of energy, a little bit of fire. So we all come from the same burning fire, in a manner of speaking, the same pool of spiritual energy. And Hashem simply, not simply, but Hashem miraculously actually, then takes these neshamas, puts them into different bodies, and that's me and you and everybody else. And we initially come from the same block of solid gold. We are, however, of course, different when it comes down to this world, and clearly different personalities. And that is the reason that the menorah had to be one solid block of gold, but yet seven lamps coming out of that one solid block of gold to teach us this amazing truth. Seven different ways but not separate, all united. The next and obvious question is, if in fact there are seven different ways, how come we all keep the same mitzvahs? Or better stated, or even stated in a different way, is it okay for everybody just to do the mitzvahs that they feel a more affinity towards? I don't get turned on by this mitzvah, that mitzvah, doesn't speak to me. I feel that it should be like this. I feel if in fact Hashem created us to be all different, if in fact Hashem actually made us seven branches, so why are we all doing the same thing, right? Why are we all doing it? So the first and simple answer to that is, that's the same as a choir getting together and saying, I like this song, I like that song, let's all sing the song that we want to sing when we're sitting there in the choir trying to perform for the audience. Everybody says that's the most ridiculous, crazy thing I ever heard of. If you're a choir and you're supposed to be singing a song, then it's true, you might like a different song better because that's just what you like, but you're taking away from the purpose of getting together. So that's, of course, the most logical initial answer. We are serving Hashem. Hashem put us here for a reason. And the reason Hashem put us here is to bring spirituality into the world, into our lives, and by extension into our children's lives, our families' lives, our community's lives, to make the world a holy place, a place that recognizes. And in order to do that, we got to be working as a team. And when you're working as a team, it doesn't matter if you want to take a coffee break right now. You can't, not if the rest of the team is counting on you to do whatever it is, like to hold up the pipe or to hold up the, or to sing the note in the middle of the choir. You can't just sit down because you're tired. It doesn't work that way. So that's the, of course, the logical answer, that the reason we can't do different things, even though we are different, is because, in fact, we're a team. In fact, we are using each of us our different abilities, but for a common goal, a common purpose, and that common purpose is to bring Hashem's presence into the world, to make ourselves and our extended communities and families and the world itself recognizing, aware of who is the boss, who is the creator, making the world, that's what it means to make the world a holy place, a place that in Hebrew, the word holy, which is kadosh, means dedicated. There's no separate word for holy. Word for kadosh in Hebrew is used anytime we want to say something is dedicated for a specific purpose, we use the word kodesh or kadosh. From the positive to the negative, from whether it's dedicated for a good purpose or dedicated for a bad purpose, or even an illegal purpose, it's still called kadosh, which means dedicated. So holiness in Hebrew means being dedicated. However, the specific instruction in the beginning of this parsha is that who should light the menorah? The Kohen should light the menorah. And the Kohen should light the menorah when standing on a step, not standing on the ground. And what that teaches us is that the process of igniting the material world, the process of making a regular wick and olive oil, because that's what they used in the Beis HaMikdash, they used olive oil. And the wicks, the Torah tells us, the Gemara tells us, were actually made from the worn out uniforms of the Kohanim. So when a Kohen's uniform would get too worn out to wear, they would take that uniform, cut it up, and make wicks. So fascinating that they used to use the uniform that the Kohen used in order to do the service in the temple, that was used as a mechanism of drawing through the oil and causing it to ignite. And the Kohen who lit the menorah had to be, again, standing on a step. And what that means is, if you want to elevate and you want to bring, so there are three details that you'd have to know about the lighting of the menorah. Number one, even though the Torah says that Aharon HaKohen should light the menorah, the halacha, the actual Jewish law, was that anybody was allowed to light the menorah. Even a person who's not a Kohen, even a Yisrael like myself, even a person who's not a Kohen. How could you light the menorah if the menorah was supposed to be lit, which is another detail in the Beis HaMikdash, in the part of the temple where an ordinary Yisrael was not allowed to even walk into? So that's a question. Maybe with a long pole, you know, standing outside. But bottom line is, if you managed to light it, it would have been kosher. Obviously, on a regular basis, it was lit actually by the Kohanim. So it had to be lit by the Kohanim. It had to be lit in the Beis HaMikdash, in the temple, and specifically in the temple, in the room called the Kodesh, the room called the Holy Room. And it had to be also lit in such a way that the flame burns well when you're lighting it. And the message, therefore, is that even though the Jewish nation is divided into seven, and we each have different ways to look at it, but who lights us? Who lights us is a Kohen who himself is elevated. But again, does this person have to be a Kohen? No, it could be a regular person too. Practical matters, it's the Kohen. But each of us, and that's the message that we need to take away from, one of the messages we need to take away from the beginning of the Parsha, is that each one of us has the ability to light and to ignite the neshama powers of our fellow Jews. Do you have to be a Kohen? No, the halacha is, even if you're not a Kohen. But do you have to act like a Kohen? Yes, you got to act like a Kohen. So being a Kohen intrinsically, nobody has claim to being special intrinsically. That means just by virtue of birth. Yes, Kohanim have claim. Yes, we Jewish nation have claim. But when it comes to doing good, when it comes to elevating our world, the material world around us, every single person, the Torah says, has the ability to do it so long as you elevate yourself, so long as you step up a couple of steps and you're ready to take on the job. Every person has the ability to change their environment. Every person's ability to take from a solid, make it into a gas, to take from olive oil that's just sitting there, to make it into a burning fire, to make it into something that's amazing to behold, to elevate. So that's another lesson from the word Beha'aloscha, when you light up, and it's said in the direct Beha'aloscha. It doesn't say Beha'alot HaKohen, when the Kohen lights up. It says Beha'aloscha, when you light up. So that word Beha'aloscha is said to each and every Jew. It's said in the second person direct, Beha'aloscha, when you light up. Each of us is given the command, and therefore the ability, and therefore the privilege to be able to go and turn around to the world around us. Each of us knows about somebody who needs something. Sometimes that somebody is ourselves. It's also nothing wrong with lighting up yourself. And by extension, if you or yourself are lit up, you're going to influence somebody, whether you like it or not. And of course, we like it. If you are excited, each of us remembers when we go through school and you remember some subject that you were very good at, or some subject that you came home and you felt good at the end of the day, you told your mother, you told your father, I really like the subject. More often than not, if you think about it, it's because your teacher was excited about the subject. You know, when it comes to understanding, we can understand this subject, but if your teacher was excited about a subject, probably you were excited too. You know, I remember myself going through school and a teacher who was really excited about this, that, the other thing. So it didn't last if I wasn't really excited about it. But at least for that moment in time, I myself was moved. Wow, this is amazing. So somebody tells you, wow, this is amazing. You start, wow, maybe this is amazing. And that is another takeaway, that we need to be able to look at our own Yiddishkeit, our own doing. And we need to be saying to ourselves, wow, this is amazing. And that's the best way to influence your kids. If you yourself think that what you're doing is, if you really think it. And how do you really think it? So you think it by studying, by learning, by understanding more. If you don't feel it right away, then it just simply means you need to learn a little bit more. You learn a little bit more and you experience a little bit more, then 100% you're going to come away. We've come from generations, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of Jews who literally gave up their lives for their Yiddishkeit. Obviously, they felt it was important. Obviously, they felt it was the most central, the most critical thing in their life. They were obviously excited to the point of putting everything on the side and risking whatever it was in order to be Jewish. And therefore, if we don't feel it, it just means we got to go back to the drawing board, learn a little more, do a little more, and then we will feel it. And once we get excited, once we become the Kohen who is elevated, who's stepping up on those steps, we elevate ourselves, then there's no question about it that by touching the flame to the wick, the shalheves, the wick will be olah me'ilah, will be going up by itself. Then you motivate the next person to the point where they're self-motivated. So you don't have to always be hovering over them. You know, we talk about helicopter moms and bulldozer moms and this and that, all these kinds of terms. But you know, at the end of the day, Jewish moms and Jewish dads, well, what do we want? We want the best. That's it. We want to take away all the problems and we want the best. But what we really want is that if we turn our backs, our children should be exactly the way we want them to be, even when we're not hovering over them. And that's the next takeaway, of course, from this whole story. The Torah tells us, the wick has to go up by itself. This is the blessing the Torah gives us. If you elevate yourself, if you walk up on those steps and you become the Kohen, even though you're not a Kohen, because again, the halacha of the law is that a non-Kohen can light the menorah. So you can become the Kohen for the moment. You can elevate yourself, even though you tell yourself, I'm not so frum, I'm not so learned, I'm not so dead. The Torah says, Narishkeit, Bavamaisis, as we say. You don't have to be so this, so that. All you have to do is care. And that is the hallmark of the Kohen. So the Torah tells us that what was the hallmark of Aaron? We read this in Pirkei Avot, Ethics of the Fathers. The hallmark of Aaron was he loved his fellow Jew. That's it. That's what it says. It doesn't say Aaron was the holiest person, even though he was. It doesn't say, in other words, when Pirkei Avot, when our sages in Ethics of the Fathers, Pirkei Avot, want to give a title to Aaron, when it tells how special Aaron is, it doesn't say he used to wake up in the morning and daven for an hour, 10 hours. It doesn't say he used to study Torah 24 hours a day, which he did. It doesn't say he was dedicated his life 100% to the service of the temple, which he was. It says the title, the compliment, so to speak, it says, Ohev Shalom, Berodev Shalom, Ohev et Habriot, Umikarvan LaTorah. The Aaron loved peace, he pursued peace, and the commentaries say that whenever he saw two people arguing, he would try to put out their argument and make peace between them. But then it says, Ohev et Habriot, he loved every individual just because they were creation of Hashem, Umekarvan LaTorah, and because he loved them, the bottom line was he tried to bring them closer to the Torah, not the other way around, is the, what our commentaries tell us, that he brings the Torah to them. He brings them to the Torah. And that is the next takeaway, that if we really truly care about somebody, we really truly want that they should have only the best, and then we understand that only the best means a connection to their neshama. I love this person, and therefore I want them to be completely connected to their own neshama, their own powers, until they should be the flame going up by itself. They should be able to be self-powered, self, and the ultimate test is, can they power somebody else? So that is another halacha that we learn in the laws of Shabbos, that when is a cloth considered to be completely soaked? Only if you put it on another cloth and that second cloth becomes wet, then the first cloth is considered to be soaked through and through. And that is the test that each of us ask ourselves. Do I have enough energy in myself to influence my kids? And then do my kids have enough energy to influence their kids and their friends? This is a tall order. It's not something that happens automatically or immediately, but it is inevitable if you take the first step. You take the first step to step up on that multi-step stone that was in front of the menorah and you elevate yourself, you're going to be taking the second step and you're going to be lighting that menorah. And then a beautiful question about the menorah itself. The menorah itself has, as we mentioned, seven lamps. So what were the seven lamps? Well, they were seven bowls, and each of the bowls on top of the menorah held a certain amount of olive oil. Gemara says half a lug of olive, about 6 ounces or so, 7 ounces of olive oil. And that was enough, Gemara tells us, to burn throughout the evening, because the menorah was lit every evening, every late afternoon, and it burned throughout the night until the morning. That every single day, that was the mitzvah of lighting the menorah, even though nobody was around, the temple service was concluded. As a matter of fact, it was lit indoors. The purpose of the menorah was not to create light the way an ordinary candelabra was. It was to create spiritual energy for the entire Jewish nation. To create, so it's a nuclear reactor that's behind doors. So you ask yourself, what's the point of the nuclear reactor if it's behind doors? Nobody can see the reaction happening. And the answer is, what kind of dumb question is that? The point is, it has to be behind doors in order that the radiation shouldn't travel. But the point is that it powers the entire city. That's what the menorah did also. It was behind doors. Yes, it's true. It was lit in this room called the Kodesh. But the point of lighting the menorah was to create a nuclear reactor power plant of spiritual energy that the entire Jewish nation benefited from. And it was, again, it was lit towards the evening, burned to the morning. There was, interesting to know, a miracle that happened with one of the seven lamps. The westernmost lamp burnt actually for twice as long as every other lamp, even though it had the same amount of oil. So a Hanukkah-like miracle that used to happen every single day in the Beis HaMikdash, that the same amount of oil actually burnt for twice as long as every other lamp, even though it had the same size wick and the same everything. But a miracle happened every day to show that Hashem's presence actually was resting on the menorah. Anyway, getting back to the menorah itself, it had seven lamps, and the seven lamps were seven bowls made out of gold. The question is, were those seven lamps attached to the menorah or not? That's the question. That means, we said before that the entire menorah was made out of one block of gold. The stem, the arms, the base, the ornamentation. Again, they were something, things that looked like knobs at each juncture of the arms didn't just have a stem and then arms coming out. It looked like a knob, like a ball, and from that came out the arms. And then there were three goblets, looked like goblets, overturned goblets. Rashi described them as Alexandrian goblets. Overturned goblets. Today we would talk about goblets that you see by water fountains. You don't really have it anymore for some reason. But you used to see these cups that were triangular. They come down to a point. They use them for snow cones. So you can't put them down. So the same way, it doesn't have a base. You can fill it up and drink from it. But because it's triangular, it comes to a pointy base, you can't put it down. So what do you have to do? You want to put it down. You got to drink all the liquid. So the same thing, there was this goblet called Alexandrian goblets. They were larger goblets, not as small as these water cooler goblets. But the point is that you filled it up with wine or some liquor, and you gave it to the person to drink, and they had to drink the whole thing out. And there were three of those Alexandrian goblets turned over actually on each of the seven lamps, the seven branches of the menorah. And then there were flower-like things, looked like flowers, but it was all made from the same piece of gold. It wasn't that they made these goblets and then soldered them on and made the flowers or the balls and soldered them on. So the question is, if the entire menorah with all its ornamentation was one block, were the bowls on top also one part? Or were the bowls removable? I mean, you had the whole menorah with the ornamentation and the arms, but the bowls themselves, you were able to, and according to one of the commentaries, called the Rishonim, Paneach Razo, one of the early commentaries, he says that yes, in fact, the bowls were removable, and the Kohen was able to take the bowl down to clean it out from the oil and from the soot of the wick, of the burning of the previous night, and then replace the bowl on top of the menorah itself. So the menorah itself was true, yes, it was one piece, but the bowls themselves, they were removable. And he says that's why it says, and this is the Paneach Razo one, again, the early commentary, lived 800 years ago, so roughly. He says that's why it says, Be'ha'aloska, when you lift up the lamp, because literally the Kohen would have to take down the bowl, lift up the lamp and replace it on its place. So that's why he says, Balos, literally, when you take the lamp and put it back on its place. Other commentaries say differently. But at any rate, assuming what's the lesson we can learn if the bowls were in fact removable? The lesson we can learn is that when it comes to filling up the menorah when it comes to filling up the oil, yes, it's true that the Kohen had to be the lighting. And what we explained was that it had to be done by elevating yourself. Yes, it's true, it had to be done in a way that the Torah demands. The Torah demands and requires certain things. You can't dilute Torah in order to create Torah. It doesn't work that way. So you have to have Torah to create Torah, meaning you cannot dilute the mitzvahs or take away the practice according to what the Torah requires and then expect to have good results. It's like a person who says, I want to create perfect fuel. I want to create a perfect cake. I want to create a sanitary condition. And I'm going to start because I want a good looking cake. I'm going to start by taking some mud from the ground and putting it in. Who cares if it's clean or not clean? And the answer is you're going to be left with dirt. If you start with dirt, you end with dirt. You want sanitary. You want something. You got to be sanitary the whole time. You can't just expect something to happen in the middle. It's a miracle. And the same is true. The previous Rebbe has a story. The Rebbe tells a story that someone came once to the previous Rebbe, and he said, Rebbe, the walls of the galus are burning. That means that the situation with assimilation is so terrible. We have to put out the fire, even if we use unorthodox methods, even if we do certain things that the Torah doesn't permit. But so what? As long as you put out the fire. So the Rebbe said to him, it's true that you can put out fire even with dirty water. But what about if that water that you think is water is not water, but it's kerosene or it's gasoline and it looks like liquid, but really is not liquid at all. Instead, it's even more flammable. So the Torah therefore demands, as we read from Pirkei Avos, that Aaron mekarvan laTorah. Aaron brought us closer to the Torah. So the question then becomes, if Aaron brought us closer to the Torah, I don't know Torah. I'm not on that level. And the answer is no. You could take the bowl down to your level as long as you fill it with pure olive oil. Start with even simple things. And even if you start with a simple thing, you will be going up. You will be lighting. And then you have to remember to replace the bowl. It has to be lit in this right place. So this is a process when the Torah teaches us, again, just to sum up, because we're coming up to 10 o'clock. Just to sum up, the Torah teaches us all of these beautiful lessons right at the beginning of the Parsha, that in order to elevate, we need to be elevating ourselves even a little bit. But each of us is different, and each of us requires something different. So long as what we are giving is Torah true, is in line with the Torah's message, we will absolutely be successful. Each of us has the ability to give, and each of us has the ability to be elevated. And all we got to do is connect even a little bit. Connect even a little bit, then, in fact, we will be successful. So this is the beginning of the Parsha. And I want to just conclude and tell you that the end of the Parsha, which is the Haftorah, the reading of the Haftorah, is a selection from one of the prophets, whose name was Zechariah. And this prophet Zechariah was a prophet at the time of the Jews coming back to rebuild the second temple. So sort of our times, the Jews were in Golos, they were in exile, in the Babylonian exile. It came time to rebuild the second temple. They were given permission to go back to Israel. And a lot of Jews were assimilated. A lot of Jews were intermarried. A lot of Jews were assimilated. And they weren't rushing to go back to take advantage of the spiritual energies that were available to them, to go back to Israel, to go back to spiritual life, to go back to the country that they had. The Golos at that time was only 70 years, not 2,000 years like we're experiencing today. So the assimilation was terrible, but still just one generation pretty much removed, two generations maybe at most removed. But at any rate, the prophet Zechariah tells us, the Jews at the time, and he tells us, and this is our Torah that we read, that he had a vision, and the vision was that the menorah of the temple was being fed by a continuous stream of olive oil. Today we would say electricity. He doesn't say electricity. There was no electricity. So you could have a menorah that's powered by olive oil that's filled up every single day, which is, in fact, that was the mitzvah to do. Or you could have a menorah that you plug in and it's electricity and you don't have to worry about it after that. And what he said was that I have this vision of a menorah, and it was a prophetic vision, that's filled by a continuous stream of olive oil that's running through tubes and filling up the lamps automatically. And this is, of course, the blessing that we give ourselves and our children and our families, that when, and again, in line with this concept of having the flames self-perpetuating, that when we do things right and we set ourselves up correctly, then what happens is that things, just because it's miraculous, things work out. Then what happens is that our life becomes illuminated. We are in a different place. Instead of having to worry about every single minute, we are plugged in, we are connected, we have electricity, we have power, we have nuclear power, which runs forever.